From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Comic Louis C.K. was one of the original writers on Late Night with Conan O'Brien. He went on to write for David Letterman and Chris Rock. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about creating his own show, Lucky Louie, the new HBO sitcom that premiered last Sunday night. Louis C.K. plays a husband and father who loves his family but is having a hard time being a family man. The program takes advantage of the fact that it's on premium cable to tackle subjects and use language that broadcast sitcoms can't. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews a new biography of a homeless man written by his social worker who became his friend. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After writing for Late Night with Conan O'Brien, The Late Show with David Letterman, and The Chris Rock Show, my guest Louis C.K. is writing for his own series. It's the new HBO sitcom Lucky Louie that premiered last Sunday after Entourage. Lucky Louie stars Louis C.K. as a husband, father of a young daughter, and part-time auto mechanic. His wife, played by Pamela Adlon, is a nurse. Louis loves his family, but is having a hard time being a family man. Louis C.K. has also done a lot of stand-up comedy. He wrote and directed the movie Pootie Tang and co-wrote the Chris Rock film Down to Earth. Louis C.K., welcome to Fresh Air. What did you want to try to do with Lucky Louie that you thought hadn't been done before on a half-hour studio audience kind of sitcom?
Well, I guess it wasn't so much that it hadn't been done before, but I knew that it hadn't been done for an awfully long time to do a show that just felt very honest and was kind of brutally funny, I guess is what I wanted to do. So you need a place that you can have really blunt edges. And today, language is part of that, you know, I think. And people really talk the way that they talk on my show to me.
Now, some of what you want to talk about that you can't really do on a broadcast mm-hmm. sitcom is to talk about sex. And in judging from the first few episodes of your show, to talk about some of the frustrations and disappointments and bad communication surrounding mm-hmm. Sex. I mean, part of it is kind of like the joylessness of sex.
Yeah, exactly. Or just the normalcy of sex. The non-fantasy of sex. Because when you're married, you still need sex. It's an important part of your life, but it's not... it's no longer a fantasy. It's a obligation to one another. And I mean that in a warm way, even though it doesn't sound warm, that you owe it to each other, to give each other this comfort, you know? But it becomes less sort of like there's no music behind it and no moans. There's just more like, hey, could you not do that to my back, please? You know, it's more sort of like familiar. So a couple trying to stay excited and happy in a marriage, I find that to be a very sweet endeavor, and it's very painful at times and very silly.
Let me ask you to describe your character of Louis on the show.
I think that I play a guy that's like me without the career that I've had, more or less. Just a guy who's, you know, graduated high school and then never got much traction, worked service industry and those kind of jobs and wasn't sure what he's supposed to be trying to do. It's the way that I felt. When I was growing up and most of my friends, the difference is that I kind of caught onto this comedy stuff and found something, but a lot of people I know didn't. And I remember what it felt like to not know where you're going to go. But what happens often is you meet somebody, you become directed by the fact that you met someone you want to be with. And so he's married to a woman who he now wants to please. And next thing he knows, he's got a kid and a lot of responsibility he doesn't feel all that prepared for. So he's trying to play catch-up a little bit. That's about it. Otherwise, he's a little frustrated, I think. I feel really dumb talking about him in the third person. It's really me.
Describe his wife. Describe his wife for us.
Oh, Kim is a nurse, and she's someone who works really hard and is raising her daughter and is fiercely protective of her and lives in the same limiting world of that, you know, when you live in these towns like, you know, Lynn, Massachusetts or Youngstown, Ohio, and you want to be healthy and you want to raise your kid without a barrage of, you know, Elmo and sugar and high fructose corn syrup, you have to really battle, you know. And I think that she sort of, to her husband will do just fine. He, you know, clean him up. He's doing just fine, basically.
But the wife in your show is always mm-hmm. trying to, in some way, control her husband's behavior. Like there's a whole episode that revolves around him really eating junk food and continuing to eat it after a good friend gets a heart attack. So
yes.
So yeah. So she's in the position kind of playing mom to her husband and saying, no, you can't, you shouldn't be eating that cake. You shouldn't be having, mm-hmm. you know, the hamburger and stuff. So is that coming out of like your marriage? Do you feel like you've put your wife in the position of having to be your mother sometimes?
Well, sometimes.
Notice how I'm blaming you.
No, of course it is. It's my fault. She's really, I think she resents having to be in that position. But I think it's close to something in my marriage and through what I've learned from a lot of this stuff. When you first get married as a guy, you just immediately are in the hole. You immediately assume that you're incapable of having a real relationship and that this woman's going to teach you. So the two of you start figuring out the guy and his problem. That's the first problem of every marriage, is what's wrong with this dumb boy of a man. Let's try to make him civilized. But then after a few years go by, you look at the woman and you go, this woman is crazy. What's wrong with her? Why does she have this need to do that? And then you end up settling, hopefully, somewhere in between. So I think both parties have problems. The guy just can't get a grip on himself. And the woman has a deep need to have the guy be just what she wants, which, it's her own issue, too, I think. And I think Kim definitely has that. She wants to grab this guy by the throat a lot. And, I don't know. I'm still haven't figured it all out.
My guest is comic Louis C.K., and he has a new series called Lucky Louis, a new sitcom on HBO. It just premiered, and it's on right after Entourage. One of the things that your character is dealing with in your show Lucky Louis is, he's trying to make friends with his neighbors next door. They're an African-American couple. He wants to be their friends. He's also very self-conscious of the fact that they're black and he's white. Mm-hmm. So in wanting to do the right thing, he often does the wrong thing. Can you talk a little bit about trying to write that relationship and what issues you're trying to raise there?
Well, that comes out of a lot of reality in my life, because it's just my generation was segregated from black people. And I grew up near Boston, which is a very segregated city. And we actually had black kids that were bussed in. I mean, it sounds like we had them bussed in for our amusement. It was fun. they were, let's get some black kids bussed in here. That's what this place needs. No, Boston had all this busing, and there was these kids that were from other neighborhoods that were black. There was zero black people lived where I lived, and they were in our school. And I used to just awkwardly sit at their table because I wanted to know them. Most people don't believe me, but I'm half Mexican, and I came to this country from Mexico. I was born here and left before I was one. And so I came here not speaking English, and I had the experience of coming here like as an immigrant, which is weird because I'm very white and Irish looking.
But you're also part Jewish.
My dad's dad was Jewish, and it's a mess, Terry. I'm a dog. I'm a mutt. But that's the way, it's great. But when I started going to elementary school and junior high school and seeing these black kids that were, I just wanted to know them, and I thought it was awkward to me that they were this other people, So I used to just sit at their table at the cafeteria during lunch and just sit there smiling and hoping they'd be my friend. They would just look at me like, what's your problem? And eventually I did make friends with a lot of them, but it had to be done awkwardly. That the races are still segregated amazingly, and the only way to actually come across and make a contact is to do it self-consciously, kind of racistly, because you're really saying I want to know you because you're black. There's just no other way to do it. And it is important to me that my daughter know black people. I want her to know everybody. I don't want her to have this. So I have to make this dumb effort. So that story became really important. And actually the part that I tell in the pilot is a true story that a black fellow...
Describe the story, yeah.
We were living actually in upstate New York at the time, a black guy, there's nobody black where we were up there. A black guy came and fixed our refrigerator, and my daughter really bonded with him over the course of a day. She was like two, and when kids are that age, knowing somebody for a day, it's like she's known him forever, She just really liked the guy, and she would say, refrigerator, and he'd say, yeah, refrigerator, refrigerator. And then we came to New York City, and we were on the subway, and she pointed at the first black guy she saw and said, refrigerator. And I was so shocked and horrified, and I thought, oh, my God, I have to get this little girl around some black people. This is not cool. And one of my best friends is Chris Rock, and it's funny because he has a daughter around almost exactly the same age, and he's having the same problem because I told him the story. He's having the same problem with his little girl who's black, is that she doesn't know enough black kids. And he has to struggle because he lives in a nice part of New Jersey. He has to make a maximum effort to make sure his daughter sees enough black people to feel comfortable and identify. So it's weird because of the segregation. You have to make these awkward, unnatural efforts.
My guest is comic Louis C.K. He writes and stars in the new HBO sitcom Lucky Louie. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is comic Louis C.K., and he has a new sitcom on HBO that he writes and stars in. It's called Lucky Louie, and it just recently premiered, and it's on right after Entourage Sunday nights. Let's talk a little bit about your character as a father on the show. Mm-hmm. You're a father of two kids?
I have two kids, yeah.
How old are they?
I have a four-year-old and a one-year-old, both girls.
The character in the sitcom seems to, you know, be a pretty caring father, but he also seems very overwhelmed by the responsibility mm-hmm. and kind of unprepared for it. Did you feel that way when you became a father, like you really weren't ready?
Oh, totally. I mean, I still feel that way because it's not like I'm done. They're 4 and 1. It's not like I can pack them off to camp now and forget about them. There's a huge amount of work to do. And it changes. It's like this is probably the worst thing I'll ever say in my life, but it's like an AIDS virus. It just keeps morphing and you can't fight it because every day you think you've figured out fatherhood and you've mixed an antidote to it. And then, you know, the next day it's like, what? Who are these people? I don't even know who these people are. They weren't living in my house yesterday. And even who am I? And who is my wife? Every day you wake up and there's a whole new... I mean, that's like some crazy kind of movie. Like that every day you wake up with a different group of people and a different home and a different set of problems. And so you never get to use any experience is just thrown in the toilet. The only experience you start to glean from any wisdom is just that, you know, be prepared for anything and just having resiliency is all you can have.
Has it been hard for you to be the authority figure and set limits for your children? Because it seems to me that when you were young, you were probably the kind of kid who was always violating those limits and defying the authority figures in your life.
Yes, that's, I don't know how you picked up on that, but that's true. No, it is weird to be saying, how don't you do this, because I identify with anybody who does something they shouldn't be doing. So including my daughters. And, you know, part of you wants them to build that strength, too. Like part of you, when your daughter's screaming at you because she doesn't want to put on her shoes or whatever crazy thing, you want to... you know, throw her in a garbage bin, but at the same time, you're proud of her and you're happy that she's building the strength and the skill to stand up for herself, you know. No, I think that's to me the crux of what this show is that is the way you feel. You feel constantly bent over and punched in the face by parenthood and marriage at the same time. And if you're honest, that's how you feel. And a lot of sitcoms that I've seen distill it to its perfect moments, where the parent is making just the right decision, because America is watching this parent and they want him to do just the right thing with perfect evenness. And I guess people get kind of a satisfaction from watching a beautifully written, balanced parental moment. But I find that really boring and I certainly don't find it funny. So the people on our show, yeah, they make awful decisions and they don't connect together as a stream of parenthood or philosophy. At least it doesn't feel that way. Maybe if we look back over what we've done with our kids, we go, yeah, I guess we're doing okay. I guess we're basically have a hand on the tiller. We're still pointing in the right direction.
I've seen 3 episodes of your show. I've had an advanced DVD. But it seems to me in the first episode, the daughter figures into it more than in the other two I've seen. And I'm wondering if she's going to be like Richie on the Dick Van Dyke Show, where like there's some episodes where they have a daughter and some, I mean, like where there's some episodes where they have a son and some episodes where they don't really seem to have a son. Is it going to be that way with your daughter on the show?
No, we don't want it to be. And it's hard to shoot with a child because, the funny thing is that's what we thought. It's really not the kid herself. It's the laws governing usage of her. In other words, she can only stay till a certain hour. Once you open her clock, you've got it. It's running fast.
Oh.
And And so we actually did one episode that is all her. It's called Discipline, and I'm not sure exactly when it airs, but it's one that I actually wrote with Pamela Adlon. We wrote it together, and it's about trying to a couple trying to clamp down and discipline their child.
So did that episode on disciplining the daughter draw on any real experiences in your life that you could tell us about?
Sure. Well, actually, the story came from Pamela because she's got three girls. Pamela Adlon, that plays my wife, and she's got this wild brood of three kids, and one of them was really, she's just been nuts, you know. She's sort of like a changeling. She turned into this crazy person, and so Pamela and her husband started trying timeouts. And at one point, Pamela told me this amazing story of putting her daughter in the laundry room and holding the door closed, and her daughter's pounding on the door and screaming, "I'm sorry!" You know, like angrily, screaming herself hoarse while Pamela's on the other side of the door, you know, bawling, trying to keep her in there. I mean, it's just, there's so much drama in just trying to do the simplest thing with your kid. And she told me this beautiful story, and we and also the undercutting. It was sort of half her story, half mine. My side of the story was that every time I try to discipline my kid, my wife would undercut. Like, I would be locked in a battle of wills with my daughter. Here's the point I got to. I was giving my daughter a bath, and I said, "It's time to brush your teeth." And she said, "No." She just refused to brush her teeth. And I said, "Okay, if you don't brush your teeth, then no books tonight. You're not going to get any books." And she said, "Yes, books, and no brush my teeth." She's like a monkey, you know, that just learned to talk. And I'm like, no brushing teeth, no books. It's that simple. Yes, books, no brushing teeth. And so, and then she said, "You brush my teeth." This is how it goes. See, it's like really tricky. "You brush my teeth." And I'm thinking, is that compromise? Am I giving in by brushing her teeth? And I just made a quick judgment and said, "No, you brush your teeth or no books." And then my wife said, from the other room, my wife was listening, and my wife said, "Can you please come in here for a minute?" And I go, "No, I can't." And then my daughter said, "Yes, go talk to mama. Go talk to mama right now," because she knew what's going to happen. So I go in the other room, and my wife says, "It's not a good idea to use books as a weapon. They're important to her. And also, I brush her teeth sometimes for her, and you should do that." And I go, "No, that's not the point. The point is, I'm right no matter what. You have to go with me. You can't do this to me." And so I go in the other room, and she says, "What did mama say?" Like that. And I'm like, "Nothing. She didn't say anything." "No, yes, she said that I don't have to. She said I don't have to." Like, she knew it. So that's what this episode is, a combination of that experience of mine and Pamela's with the timeouts. And it was a really interesting one to shoot, because I give this kid a timeout in the closet of our apartment. And we were really afraid that, or we expected that, the audience would boo me and that I would be a tyrant throughout the episode, because it's me trying to have this iron fist in this house. But when we shot it, people were cheering me and applauding, and they were booing Pamela, and they were booing the kid. They booed the kid. So we're constantly shocked by people's reaction. That's one of the funnest parts, is being surprised.
What were some of the sitcoms that you grew up with, the ones that you particularly liked and the ones that you particularly did not?
I always liked All in the Family. I loved. And I always loved The Honeymooners when I would see it in reruns and stuff. Even more so later in life, The Honeymooners. But I just thought All in the Family was such an awesome show. And I also liked Good Times. And also Barney Miller, which doesn't have much relation to this show, except for that the people on Barney Miller are very ordinary. You would never see a guy like Jack Sue being the star of a sitcom today, or the dude that played Wojciechowicz. You know, those were just average Americans. And so there was a lot I loved about that show, too. I didn't like shows like, and this is just personal, subjective, I don't judge these shows, they just didn't hit with me. Shows like Cheers, when I started getting older, and Frasier in those shows, and Friends, I just don't connect with those shows. They're very slick, and they're very perfect, And the people are pretty, and they're shot very nicely. And they stopped feeling like these raw theatrical productions that I grew up watching, these Norman Lear shows where people are just dropping wild, wild statements in front of an audience, and that you just feel the kinetic energy of this kind of honesty. That's what I thought sitcoms were supposed to be. So when they became this kind of trading of Harvard-written writerly lines and, you know, cuteness, I stopped being interested. That's just personal.
Louis C.K. writes and stars in the new HBO sitcom Lucky Louie. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Art of War by Sun Tzu, in stores and online at bn.com. From Carnegie Corporation of New York, with a foundation created by Andrew Carnegie to promote the advancement and diffusion of knowledge and understanding. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Louis C.K. talks about writing for Conan O'Brien and Chris Rock, and Maureen Carrigan reviews a new biography of a homeless man written by his social worker. It was a bestseller in Great Britain and was just published in the States. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with comic Louis C.K. He's written for Conan O'Brien, David Letterman, and Chris Rock. Now he's writing and starring in the new HBO sitcom Lucky Louie, which premiered last Sunday night. He plays a husband, father, and part-time auto mechanic who's having trouble making ends meet. When we left off, he was telling us that he liked working-class sitcoms like All in the Family, The Honeymooners, and Barney Miller, but he didn't relate to shows like Cheers, Frasier, and Friends, because the characters were very attractive and their dialogue sounded like it was written by Harvard grads.
The thing is, you know, you're talking about these working class type of sitcoms that you really related to and not relating to the more, you know, middle class or upper middle class ones. Though Cheers was officially working class.
Officially, yeah.
But, you know, your character Louis is, on the sitcom, is a part-time mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
Your parents met at Harvard, from what I read. So if they met at Harvard and were going to school there...
Mm-hmm. Well, my mother was from Michigan, and she went to school in Michigan, but she went to Harvard for her summer school 1 year, and that's where she met my dad, who was a Mexican migrant student, I guess you'd call it. He was going to take some grad school classes there. They're not like two well-raised rich people that went to Harvard. My mother sort of saved and bought herself some classes at Harvard, and my dad came up to try to finish his schooling there. My dad is, I mean, when I was growing up, he was still trying to pursue a degree, I think. And my mom raised us. She taught school part-time, and she worked as a computer programmer, which she still does today. Mm-hmm. And so she really supported us. And actually, my parents were divorced when I was about 10 years old. So I was really raised by my mom, a single mom, with four kids in a half of a house. We had rented the lower half of a two-family house, cramped little place. And so we didn't have anything. When I was growing up, we had no money. And a memory that my sisters and I always laugh about is saying to my mother, Mom, I'm hungry. And she'd say, well, make yourself a bologna sandwich. And I'd go, well, I don't like bologna. And she'd say, well, then you're not that hungry. So that's how we were raised. And notice that I'm making myself the bologna sandwich. My mother never made us any. We had a microwave, which meant we made our own meals. And it was just we fended for ourselves. She worked all day. She had a huge amount of work to do raising us. So everyone had to sort of pitch in. And so I watched her go through a lot of times where there wasn't a lot. And she educated herself. She went and got herself a computer experience and started to do that.
But when you were getting raised by your mother,
mm-hmm.
and she had four kids and worked all the time, mm-hmm. were you sympathetic to that? Were you like angry with her because she wasn't like cooking your dinner, or were you sympathetic helpful to the fact, you know, to her because you saw that how difficult it was for her?
I did, absolutely, and I always thought of that. She never made us feel guilty or anything, but I always felt like we all felt like we were in the effort together. We'd all go shopping together, you know, and my mother tried, you know, she was very kind. So, like, if you got to go shopping with her, it was great because she would always get a bag of cookies and open them while we shopped. We'd eat them while we shopped. And, you know, so I liked her. I liked my mom. She's nice. So, yes, I did sympathize with her. And actually, I didn't go to college because she had three girls in college when I graduated high school. And she was really struggling mightily because Ronald Reagan was president and he didn't care what you were coping with. You just had to pay on your own. So when I graduated high school, I was such a lousy student that I thought I can't just go, like some of my friends that had more money were just going to college just to go drink and just because that's what you do next. But I really couldn't see doing that because I knew she couldn't really afford it. So I just passed and didn't go continue school because I didn't want to cost her the money. I guess that was the one thing I did that was the most sympathetic to my mom.
How did you end up in comedy? Your first career, I think, was working as a mechanic.
It wasn't really a career. I did it while I was doing comedy at night. I would go work in garages fixing mufflers and brakes and stuff. And I loved fixing cars. I actually did think at one point that that's what I wanted to do because I was able to do it. But I just loved stand-up my whole life, and I grew up in Boston, and I heard something on the radio about open mic night at a comedy club that anyone that wanted to could go in and try it. And as soon as I knew that existed, I went and tried it. And I was very bad and unfunny, and I bombed. And I tried it again, and I was bad again. But I just kept at it, and it was an obsession with me. And when I was in junior high school, I did a lot of drugs, and I got in a lot of trouble. So I think that when I started doing that stuff, my mother was unbelievably supportive. I lived at home at some ages that I shouldn't have. I would leave and then come back. And she was always very helpful because I just wasn't any longer a criminal drug addict. She was so happy that I was doing anything legal.
Eventually, David Letterman hired you to be a writer on his show, and this was after you were a guest on his show. Did you so impress him as a guest that he hired you as a writer?
No, it was kind of the other way around, because I had written on Conan. I was there from the beginning of the show. Me and a bunch of guys got hired as writers before it was on the air, so I got to launch that show with the first writing staff, which was a singularly great experience. And after I was gone from there, I'd been there for 2 years and I left, and then the Letterman show kind of heard that I was sort of one of the good writers on Conan, so they wanted to snap me up and they offered me a writing job, and I said, you gotta let me be a stand-up on the show first, because that was my dream, to do stand-up on Letterman. So they let me do stand-up on the show first, and the following week I was hired as a writer.
My guest is comic Louis C.K. He writes and stars in the new HBO sitcom Lucky Louie. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is comic Louis C.K. He writes and stars in the new HBO sitcom Lucky Louie. He's also written for Conan O'Brien, David Letterman, and Chris Rock. Well, let's talk about being one of the first writers on Conan O'Brien's show and launching the show. You know, just to refresh everybody's memory, when Conan O'Brien's show started, everybody thought he would fail. Like, who is this guy, and why was he chosen to get this prestigious late night spot that everybody wanted? So what were some of the things that you tried to think of as a writer to help establish like who he was and what the show's identity was?
It's funny. We didn't really think that way. We just were, very young. I mean, everybody was young. When I met Conan, he was 30, which amazes me now. And Robert Smigel, who was the head of that show, was 29. And I was 25, I guess. And the writers ran the range between those ages. But anyway, we just were trying to be really funny. And Conan, what I really admire him more about than anything was how much courage he had then, because he really was an unpracticed, uncertain performer. But he tried bits that I've seen really veteran comedian and broadcasters walk away from because they're just too risky and too strange. But he'd go, sure, I'll try that. For all of his greenness, he was like, yeah, I'll try that completely ridiculous bit that will probably bomb, and he would stand there and sell it.
Can you think of an example?
Last night on Conan O'Brien, and then we'd show these really lush action sequences that would make it look like Conan's show was like Dallas with cliffhangers at the end of every show. And we had like cars going off cliffs that we borrowed footage from stock footage companies. But yeah, him and they would be having fist fights and, you know, women dressed in, gowns yelling at each other and stuff. That stuff was actually pretty easy to laugh at and pretty fun. But then I'd hang Conan out to dry on other stuff what's a good example? I remember it's kind of a important thing for a writer to go through, to watch somebody bomb with your material and feel the empathy for them and realize the positions you put them in. We did a thing on Conan that I created called Actual Items, where we do the thing where you show small town news and you're amazed at how silly the items are and you say how they're real, but we would make ours up so they'd be ridiculous, you know? We had one that I wrote that was for coins. Sometimes in like TV Guide, you see old coins for sale that you can mail away for. Mm-hmm. And the thing said, these coins are so old that you could buy slaves with them. And, an awfully offensive joke. And he didn't really want to do it. But I said, come on, don't be a baby. And he did it, and it got roundly booed. And he sat there with a big smile on his face, and he just took that boo. And I was sitting safely by the doors. Nobody was bothering me. I learned at that moment, like, it's just not fair to make other people bomb with your stuff, as cute as you think it is.
Now, you used to write for the Chris Rock show, his HBO variety kind of show. And I think people are probably very surprised to hear that because so much of Chris Rock's humor is about being black, and you're not black. So, did you end up writing sketches that are, or writing monologues that are about being black? And if so, what's that like?
Well, it's funny. When I started writing at Chris Rock, I think a lot of us, the white writers, were conscious of it. And at one point, Chris said, stop thinking of this as a black show. This is not a black show. Just write the weird stuff you did at Conan and write it here. And once I started thinking that way, I did. And there are some things I would write that were, like we did this thing with this guy, Mario Joyner, would come on and play a lot of characters. So we did an interview with this guy that I wrote where he's complaining to Chris that black people are segregated and still that you can't, there's places that white black people can't go because they're black. And he shows hidden camera footage of himself trying to get into a restaurant and they kick him out just because he's black. And we show the footage, though, and he's naked, completely naked. And so he walks in the restaurant and people are angry and throw money. He says, you see that? They threw me out because I'm black. And he's trying to get a cab and nobody will stop. And he's completely naked. And so that was, but to me, that was the silly Conan humor, but done through, you know, done on a show that had, you know, that was more about being black, you know. So that it was the same kind of silly stuff, but.
But did you get grief for that from people saying, "Oh, you're making light of real discrimination"?
I never heard it. I just heard loud laughter from Chris's mostly black audience. Thought it was hilarious, and we do bits on that show that had nothing to do with being black. A lot of them, like we had a fake PSA, like those Latter-day Saints PSAs. A black guy and a white guy see each other on a dark street, and they're both scared, and you hear their interior monologue, you know, what is he doing in my neighborhood? You know, is he going to rob me? Yeah, those were always funny to me, too, because, like, the black guy's worried the white guy's going to rob him. You know, come on. Not really. But so the black guy and the white guy meet on the street, and they're both kind of scared, and they say, what do you want? You want something? Maybe I do want something. And then all of a sudden they start making out, like just kissing, really. And we got this interracial gay couple to shoot this with us. And then the voiceover says, gay sex brings men together of all races. And that it's like, you know, gay sex, the whatever. And it was brought to you by the Church of Latter-day Gay Sex. That was HBO. You could do that. Anyway, that got about 4 minutes of sustained laughter and screaming from his audience. That was one of my favorite moments of my life, probably, was when we first showed that to Chris's audience. And they just went berserk. It was great.
Let's get back to your new sitcom on HBO, Lucky Louie. Mm-hmm. You play a character called Louie. You are a character. You are a real person named Louie. So, yeah. You know, there's a history of this now on TV, and I know that you're friends with Seinfeld. You mm-hmm. used to open for him, I think.
Years ago.
Okay. So, did you ask him for advice on, like, things to be careful of when you're doing a show, when you're doing a sitcom with your name in the title? Where the line between you and the character is a little blurry.
I guess I don't care if there's a line or not. Like, I don't feel any. I don't think it's important that there be a line. I did call Jerry. I used to open for him back when I was very young, and he gave me a lot of really great advice back then. He was very giving that way. And I lost touch with him. I didn't know him really during having his show. But I'm good for one call. Like, if I call Jerry, he'll call me back, as long as I keep it down to, like, once every 2 years. Like, I can't keep calling Jerry. The best advice I ever got from Jerry was when I was, like, 19, and I opened for him in a theater. And it was, like, an amazing audience. And I would do a joke, and instead of laughing, they would applaud. And I'd never had that happen before. Like, long applause breaks. And I didn't know what to do during the applause. I just sit there going, what do I do now? So I asked Jerry, what do you do during applause? And he says, you have to stay in the bit. They're applauding and reacting to what you just said. So just stay in that moment. Just inhabit that moment until they're done applauding. That was the best comedy advice I ever got. And I still use it on the show. I mean, I tell all the actors on my show that. Because the nature of our show is that it's shot in front of an audience and that the audience mitigates the performance. So when people say something explosive, which we often do on this show, often the audience goes crazy and they have to wait it out. And a lot of people weren't used to that and they said, what do I do? And I said, just stay in it. Stay in the moment. The thing you said that got that response, your face should still be saying it and just hold it.
your show, in a way, has the look of an earlier sitcom, like from the earlier days of television, maybe like the Honeymooners era or something, where it's kind of shot almost in real time, and though it's shot, it's not shot on film. I think it's shot on video.
That's right.
But is there a certain look that you were going for?
No, definitely. Because when I started, I did research when I started making this show, and I wanted to do a show that felt really real and that was just based on the comedy. And I went back and I looked at All in the Family, and I realized that at a time where they were shooting a lot of television on film that was shot on videotape, like Mary Tyler Moore was shot on film, and it's very nice looking and very lush. But there's something disconnecting about film. It, like, you're watching an image that was projected onto celluloid, and it's not real. But videotape just feels immediate and naked and very raw. And so when I watched the All in the Family episodes, I realized this show had a very raw, beautifully naked feel to it. And I actually called Norman Lear. I got him on the phone because somebody told me that Norman Lear shot on video because they forced him to for budget reasons. And I called him and I asked him, and he said, absolutely not. They wanted me to shoot All in the Family on film, and I demanded videotape because it felt like you were there, like a theatrical experience, and because it made the interaction with the audience seem real. And then I contacted the people that made Roseanne, because Roseanne was the last show shot on videotape. That's a sitcom. And they said the same thing. Roseanne demanded that it be video. And she said she liked it because it's like the news. It's like you're watching the news. You're not watching some fancy show. You're just watching people that happen to be on the news. So we got the same videotape that, like, the football games are shot on or the news is shot on. And we made the sets. We got the Honeymooners blueprint, actually, of
you
their
did?
Set. Yeah, I went and found that and looked at their dimensions and studied them. And our set is actually half the size of Ralph's set because he was enormous. And also he shot on with cameras that had much different lenses. So things look a lot smaller back then. But anyway, we wanted to make a set where there's no tchotchkes. I just think there's so much put into, like, the realism of sitcom sets that it takes away from the funny. When you watch sitcoms that are shot on sets, that there's tons of design choices on the walls and Williams-Sonoma and throw pillows and a big couch and that stuff, I find it very distracting. So what I asked for was just a set where it's just blank walls, like the Honeymooners, just nothing. And I wanted to be in a little box and have nowhere to go and have the energy just stay trapped. And we don't have a couch. We're the only sitcom you'll ever see these days that doesn't have a sofa.
You have a kitchen table.
We have a kitchen table and chairs. And so people have to sit upright or stand and really hurl at each other. Like, it's really, it makes it very confrontational. And everything's hard wooden linoleum. And if you look at the bedroom on our set, the bed isn't in the center, you know, these master bedrooms that these rich sitcom people live in with a nice table and lamp on each side. Where the bed's shoved over to the wall, which makes it very hard to shoot bedroom scenes. And there's a scabbed-in door, like the landlord just put in some drywall and faked a door into our apartment. It's a really miserable place that we live in. But it echoes where I lived when I lived in Greenpoint with my wife and kid. We lived in just a disgusting place where you're smoking your neighbor's cigarette constantly through the wall. And, you know, and you have no choices. And there's a big transformer outside of our window that's going, which I wanted to actually put that sound in throughout
really
the soundtrack
annoying,
of the
that's
show.
That's annoying sound.
It's horrible. Yeah, we couldn't have had that. But so we really worked hard to make this that way, to make it realist, but also very theatrical and flat looking. We want people to be focused on the performers and the writing.
Well, good luck with it, and thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Louis C.K. writes and stars in the new HBO sitcom Lucky Louie. It premiered last Sunday night. Coming up, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews a new biography of a homeless man written by his social worker. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
The new biography, Stuart, A Life Backwards, describes the life of a homeless man through the eyes of the social worker who became his sometime friend. Stuart was published in Great Britain last year. It became a bestseller, won the Guardian First Book Prize, and was shortlisted for both the Samuel Johnson Prize and the Whitbread Biography Prize. Book critic Maureen Corrigan investigates this unlikely success of a book.
Stuart Shorter may have been a disaster of a human being, but he turned out to be a natural genius when it came to book editing. Shorter spent roughly half of his life of 33 years either in prison or on the streets. Indeed, he met his biographer, Alexander Masters, when Alexander came upon him drunk and crumpled up in a doorway on a shopping street in Cambridge, England. Alexander was then working in a homeless outreach center, and he became intrigued by Stuart's erratic combination of filth and charisma, good manners, and knife-wielding violence. Over the next few years, Alexander began to interview Stuart about his life as a glue-sniffing alcoholic who detoured occasionally into heroin, psychosis, armed robbery, and hostage-taking. Alexander wrote up a first draft of a biography. Stuart read it and issued this quintessentially working-class British verdict. It's bollocks boring. He told Alexander that he droned on too much with academic quotes and sociological research. And then Stuart gave an inspired piece of direction to Alexander. Write it the other way around. Make it more like a murder mystery. What murdered the boy I was? See? Write it backwards. With this editorial advice, quoted on page 6 of the biography, Stuart particularly nails the attention of every parent reader out there, anxious to find the vaccination that will inoculate their own children from devolving into a Stuart. What murdered the boy I was? Those words also turn out to be Stuart's boffo exit line, for as Alexander quickly tells us, Stuart stepped in front of a speeding passenger train before he could ever read the final manuscript. The great thing about the Brits is that they may be sentimental about dogs and gardening, but they're much less pious about their fellow human beings than we Americans are. As I've just noted, there's no redemptive ending to this biography. You know, if Hollywood gets its hands on this book, and the film rights have been sold, Robin Williams will play Stuart as the misty-eyed, lovable tramp. But Alexander's biography of Stuart is exasperated with him to the point of nastiness. Alexander states many times that he finds his subject a repulsive nuisance whom he wishes would off himself. Despite Alexander's disgust, however, he can't help but keep picking at the scabrous mystery of Stuart. The result is a strange and absorbing helter-skelter biography filled with moments of horror, everyday tedium, and black humor, visually augmented by sketches of bleak locales, such as the underground parking garage Stuart called home for a while. Drawing on his larger experiences as a social worker, Alexander also serves up defeatist anecdotes about the legal and social services systems, including a hilarious narrative describing his efforts to garner publicity about the case of two charity workers who've been wrongly imprisoned. After weeks of planning and fundraising, Alexander organizes a tent city of the homeless to camp out in London in support of the workers. But his demonstrators keep wandering off in search of vodka, drugs, and sex. When Jack Straw, the Home Secretary, deigns to show up at the encampment, Alexander tells us that Straw is met by a reception committee consisting solely of a middle-aged drunk and two deaf homeless people engrossed in stealing each other's hearing aids. There are indeed some real answers in Stuart as to what murdered a chipper young boy into a wreck of a man. But the world here isn't set reassuringly right again, Agatha Christie fashion, once Alexander unmasks the demons that plagued Stuart's childhood. Too much is cosmically out of kilter. In a fit of despair a few years into writing about Stuart, Alexander gets drunk, wakes up with a hangover, and thinks, "I can't hope to justify or explain Stuart, I realize. Just staple him to the page." Alexander does succeed in stapling Stuart to the page, but the triumph of this odd biography is that it always gives the reader the sense of Stuart perversely wiggling out of those staples.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Stuart, A Life Backwards by Alexander Masters. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a 1961 recording by Errol Garner. He was born 85 years ago today.
Support for NPR comes from Delacorte Press, publisher of A World Undone, The Story of the Great War, 1914 to 1918, by G.J. Meyer. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life. Online at pewtrusts.org. And from Picture House, presenting the Robert Altman film A Prairie Home Companion, with a cast that includes Tommy Lee Jones, John C. Reilly, and Meryl Streep, now in theaters. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Meg Wolitzer talks about her novel The Position, which has just been published in paperback. Also from our archive, an interview with the founder of America's Black Holocaust Museum, James Cameron, who survived a lynching. He died this week at the age of 92. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.